more than to another member, the local gentleman. We will be getting everything from Dr. Nomo on the hand, on the top, national strategy plan, strategic plan for AWS, STI 2007, 2011. You are aware, honorable members. This reviews the strategic plan that we had from 2000 to 2006. And it now is a process involving a wide range of people to actually do now this new task and make comments, submissions, and actual participation process, which the government is actually going to take us through all the processes. Can I send over to you? I think it's the first time since your appointment, your coming to the Fellowship of Holocaust. Thank you very much. You are most welcome. You are very, very, very happy to be here. Come join us. Especially the most important of your presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide this briefing on a China-driven process of the development of the national multi-sectoral strategic plan for HIV and AIDS and STIs as well for the period 2007-2011. We circulated copies of the old NSP that the chairperson has referred to, the 2000-2005, so we have a historical perspective of where we're coming from. We're also circulating a copy of the assessment that we did on the implementation of the level of implementation of that plan. The new national strategic plan that I call this NSP going forward, the new NSP is still in the draft form, and the chairperson has referred to this kind of work that is currently underway, and we will make this available as soon as that has been adopted by SANAC. As I mentioned, that this is a SANAC driven process. This work, if I may mention, occurs concurrently with the restructuring of SANAC. And in this regard, I'm happy to report that there is now agreement on the structure that the SANAC should form. And the recommendations on the structure, in fact, have been adopted by Cabinet and also by the old Council going forward. But in terms of the presentation itself, the purpose is to brief the committee on the approach that was taken in the drafting of this NSP, on the actual draft content, we say we're still working on it, on progress, as well as plans towards finalization of the plan. As I outline the approach to this specific presentation, is we'll give some background and we'll provide a brief report on the assessment and the copy of that is in the file. And the draft NSP will provide a summary and some recommendations to the committee afterwards. By way of background, the Department of Health was mandated by the South African National AIDS Council in May 2006 to lead a process of developing a new framework for HIV and AIDS and STI. It was agreed at that meeting that largely the NSP 2000-2005 is still relevant, because it embodies a multi-sectoral approach. It's a statement of intent for the whole country, not a health sector plan. And all government departments and other sectors of civil society should be guided by this plan. We were also mandated to maintain the key priority areas because of the relevant still, and that because also it requires a longer period to implement these interventions before you can realize some of the impacts that we're all looking for. So 5 years wouldn't be enough to implement just specific interventions. You need to carry on with that for quite a period to realize the impact. We did a desktop review then of that plan, and these are some of the findings that you'll find in the report that you file. We completed this work of assessment, the desktop review, in September 2006. The despite its methodological limitations, we found actually that assessment to be useful because it did to some, give some sense of the extent of the implementation. It provided important information for the development of the new NACP. But what it also did was to strengthen stakeholder involvement in the processes as a whole. The final report was then submitted to the Department of Health, and it has been distributed. What concludes this assessment is that the framework, which is the NACP 2005, has fulfilled its task to a great extent. Remember, it's a high-level sort of statement of intent. And this, by giving direction to all stakeholders in the country, majority of national programs on HIV and AIDS have been formulated on the basis of that framework. Partnerships in the fight against HIV and AIDS have, through this NSP, broadened. And most people come on board. Implementation of the program, though, tended to be a bit vertical. The problem with a lack of clear M&E framework and clear targets was identified as a major gap, and therefore you won't find in that report quantity data that is reliable because of that. Also, one other challenge that was identified was overall coordination at SANAC level and with civil society were weaknesses implementing that plan. There are some recommendations that came out for government specifically. We were advised to review the approach and content of the ABC message to strengthen government implementation in general, the whole program, not only in the health department but in other government departments as well. Sustain existing partnerships, strengthen the implementation of cooperative agreements among other members, and strengthen the coordination and the M&E elements of the plan. For civil society, these are some of the recommendations. They enable SANAC representatives to fulfill their mandates of coordinating for specific. So what we found in SANAC was people would come to meetings, but they didn't have the sort of constituency influence of going back there and sharing the information with their constituencies so that there is that level of coordination. Increased business, because continuing field business could be better than it's doing currently, establish an M&E plan for all civil society sectors as much as it was a weakness of government, it was even a worse weakness, worse civil society sector. Consider the needs of the disabled, where we have a very loud voice on the disabled, people with disabilities, sectors, and level, so you only find this coming up. Now we took that and used some of it to inform the NSP 2007-2011 going forward. And that plan is informed, as I say, by the previous framework as mandated by SANAC, by the findings of the assessment 2000-2005, by the current status of the HIV and AIDS epidemic. We're not where we were in 2000. Things have developed somewhat and we need to recognize that. Scientific developments have been recognized. Current policy and legal environments also inform this new plan. The assessment of capacities in terms of what is feasible and practical and realizable has come into the functioning of coming with the draft plan. Available interventions and resources, we could wish for many things, but what is available and what resources are available to do all of this. And input also from a majority of critical stakeholders were considered. So then, the Department of Health developed the first draft and led several consultations. The first draft, in fact, was consulted in a large group of civil society and government departments and provincial departments of health on the 20th of October. And there have subsequently been a series of these consultations, and this has evolved to what we now have as a February 2007 version of draft 8 of that plan, which itself is divided into 13 sections, as I say, and as mandated by SANAC. There are no fundamental deviations from the 2005 because of the mandate. SANAC but also because we are aware that there's no major upgrades in terms of additional interventions to consider at this stage. you find that when you get a court who has adopted the Jews, the structure of that document is the usual forward, executive summary, introduction and process. We have an update there on the epidemiology of HIV and AIDS. There's a special section on TB/HIV, which we're still working on. We have a section on women, youth, and children as the most affected sector of the population. We think that, just as Peter was saying, the epidemic now has probably reached its peak at about 5 million estimated to be living with HIV. It's mainly affecting young women in the age group 55 to 55, who most of them will be living in formal settlements, both urban and rural. But we are mindful of the fact that, and we communicate this to the public, that everyone is at risk. It's not only the young women in informal settings, but everyone is indeed. So also we note with concern the increasing incidence and mortality from TB and is outlined in the background of that. What informs this information is basically mainly surveys, and largely is the Department of Health annual ANC surveillance, which is the most robust and most reliable source of information on issues of prevalence. We cited also work done by the Medical Research Council, by State South Africa, modeling from the Actuarial Society of South Africa, the 2OC model. We get information also from UNAIDS behavioral surveys, demographic surveys, and also the household survey that was done by the Human Science Research Council. What we do then is put this all together and do what is called triangulation and come up with a broad set of figures that gives information on the different sectors of the population. The next task team is working on this section, is basically improving on what the Department of Health has submitted to Ghana. It's led by an actuarial scientist and an epidemiologist, who are some of the best in the country. It defines the character, the dynamics, the trends, and so on. The recognition of TB as the most important opportunistic infection, I cannot overstate this, so you find it coming up now again in the presentation. Challenges mainly with TB control, with TB HIV co-infection, and now recently, and sadly so, the involvement, the development of extremely resistant TB. In terms of sexually infections other than HIV, we note the gains as evidenced by the decrease in syphilis, and you'll find this in the ANC surveillance. But there are still challenges with partner management. We give as many manifestation slips as we can. We find that the return rates if we get 30% return rates, we're lucky, and we need to work on that through social mobilization and community mobilization. There is now, we are noting then also, the emergence of resistance of one of the commonest STIs, especially affecting men, so-called drop, and we find, especially in KZN, that the drugs that we have available in the hospital drug list are not adequate to treat that, and work has been done. In fact, the people now in that province have been changed. In terms of genital herpes, these are ulcers that you find in the genitalia, but are mainly due to viruses. This is not by bacteria. We're finding that the importance in increasing acquisition and transmission of HIV, and we need to do that going forward. We need, particularly around the management of the STIs, to engage the target sector effectively. There's a session in the plan that speaks to responses up to this far, and we take a lot, obviously, from the assessments that we've done. We refer going backwards from the Makosa period, 1992 to 1997, and going adding that to 2000 to 2005. So there is a lot of progress in many of these areas. Still too many challenges, and the task team has started to put all of this together and concretize it into some general risk assessment statement. What are the things that we didn't do well previously that now we need to make sure that we improve on going forward? There's a section there that speaks to the structural organization or organizational arrangement, and its development here basically relates to the revival of the Interministerial Committee, which we saw towards the end of the year, the role of the social cluster of government, which is a new development as well, provision of the national health system and relevant structures, mainly the National Health Council in the policy formulation committee, the National Health Consultative Forum, which is a health sector-based multi-forum that engages on some of these issues. And also another development is the new structure of SANAC that I have mentioned in the introduction, which has been approved by the current SANAC, approved by cabinet. I have to say, though, that the approval from cabinet came with a caveat that said we should consider expanding the mandate to include other important health issues, especially TB. Sectors are working on representation on this new structure. Provincial and district level coordination centers will be formed once the new SANAC has not finalized. And we need also to make sure that we do this mobilization and the structural arrangements at community level so that there's meaningful participation by communities at that level. What are some of the guiding principles? What stands out as the most important? Some of them have been outlined in the comprehensive plan, and I have to just remind the committee members that we do actually have a health sector comprehensive plan which was approved by cabinet in November 2003, and this needs to be seen as a On the question of principles, it's mainly what to really and remind the members of the committee about the comprehensive plan, which itself is a health sector plan that was approved by cabinet in 2003. Often a question comes, what's the difference between this comprehensive plan and this now NSP that you're coming up with? The major difference is that comprehensive plan is a health sector plan, and this NSP is a multi-sectoral plan. Comprehensive plan has got two main goals. One is to strengthen the second element of the broad multi-sectoral strategy, which is treatment care support. The other goal of the comprehensive plan is to ensure, to facilitate the strengthening of the health system specifically. But in terms of the principles that are outlined, the questions of prevention and equitable provision of services, good quality services, will be outlined in that, which I think are critical, important also for the NSP going forward. On the other hand, the NSP is much broader in terms of priority areas, but also in terms of guiding a broader base of stakeholders and sectors. The leading role of government is outlined as one of the important principles in the plan. Human rights issues around confidentiality, non-discrimination, particularly affecting people living with HIV, women, people with disabilities, children, and other marginalized groups. We're thinking here, men who are sex with men, commercial sex workers, mobile populations, and so on. Importance of the national movement on moral regeneration and mainstreaming of values. It may sound nebulous, but it's an aspect that we think is very important to consider. Social mobilization and meaningful community participation came up over the stage. All of these interventions that we put or are recommending there have to be evidence-based strategies, have been proven to work and make a difference in many situations. Stigma remains a huge challenge. Holistic approaches, we say, the way to approach all of these interventions should be holistic and comprehensive. We need to make sure that we leverage better on the private sector than we currently do. M&E is a critical element, and also for us to be able to do all of these things, the environment needs to support the implementation of these interventions to provision of predictable and sustainable financial resources, availability of commodities and harmonization of aid. There's a lot of donor organizations coming into the country, and we need to make sure that we harmonize that for better efficiency and effectiveness. And the task team is working on crafting these principles so that they concretize nicely. So the actual meat of the plan then, what are the goals of the NSP? the primary aim, we maintain the one that you see in the 2005, which is basically to reduce the rate of new infections, as well as to reduce the impact on individuals, families, and communities. The key and the four key priority areas are maintained from old: prevention, treatment, care, and support, M&E and research, human and labor rights. Ladies and gentlemen, members of the committee, this NSP is actually the statement of intent. It is the what and the how much this time, because we didn't have targets previously, in terms of targets. You won't see outlined in the plan the operational issues of how to implement these interventions. That is left to the implementing agencies and the policy makers. There will be some guidance in terms of where there are policy gaps. We would advise governments and others to see if that those gaps are indeed addressed so that people are able to operationalize this strategy. But once more, this is work that is is in progress by the task team. So what are we saying about prevention? We are having a very ambitious target of aiming to reduce new infections by 50% over the 5-year period. And under that, under prevention, what are the things then that need to be done to assist us get there? Five goals have been identified, and in each of them, we put targets and indicators to monitor their implementation. We also identify the lead agencies who would contribute in what activity to assist us get to the 50% reduction over the 5 years. One of the goals is to reduce vulnerability. In our view, we think that the fundamental drivers of this epidemic are actually poverty, underdevelopment, and the gender imbalances. And so we need to make sure that we mainstream in the current programs that are underway in the country and the government, mainstream the issues of HIV. And the new hope is that as people become more affluent and so on, there will be some level of contribution to the reduction. This is one area that we found difficult to put specific targets in, but we think that it's important to put it there, recognize it, name it, recognize it, and put it there as one of the things important to do. The other goal is about reducing sexual transmission. Remember, there's about three main ways of getting HIV infection in this country, and it's largely heterosexual transmission. So reduce the sexual transmission, reduce mother-to-child transmission, but also reduce transmission via blood. So those are the three main areas that we target in to reduce transmission. In terms of sexual transmission, we say some of the things that we need to do is social mobilization for behavior change. A huge challenge indeed. With the recommendation from the assessment was that we should balance the ABC message. Yes, we will do some work around that. Mutual monogamy is one key message that needs to get across South Africans. We need to make sure that we enlist on men as partners so they can contribute to the system with this behavior change intervention. Consistent use of condoms. It's not now just going to be used condoms, it's going to be consistently use condoms, because that's where infectiveness lies. Delays in sexual debut, specifically targeting the younger population. Gender-based violence issues need to be addressed in messages and also linked to programs that are currently underway in this regard. Substance, I'll put AB use there, but it's not only substance abuse, it's substance use as well, just mere alcohol use. People have disinhibition and they find themselves doing things that they would have done if they didn't take. Education continues as one of the key interventions in behavior change. Still on preventing sexual transmission, so there are some specific target high-risk groups. We realize that the South African HIV and AIDS epidemic is a generalized epidemic and is able to propagate on its own, even without the contribution of commercial sex workers and men for sex with men. It will propagate on its own. But there is that specific group that needs specific attention, and those are the ones that we outlined there. Workplace programs and health business have to come to the party in a bigger way than it's currently doing. Increased access to men and female condoms, I mentioned sexual debut, that is a specific target group. post-exposure prophylaxis for sexual victims of sexual assault link also to developments in the regulations and so on in this regard. Certain STI control program will mention what the challenges are there and we need to deal with them. Youth services need to be strengthened and intervention now calls positive prevention with the targets. People have been found to be HIV positive already with those specific interventions. I said the other way of transmitting HIV is through mother to child, and the main goal that we call that reduce the rate of HIV incidence among the less than 5 children. Mainly they get it from their mothers. So this is essentially the PHCT program. But what about the PHCT program? We need to increase coverage of the target population, coverage of the estimated HIV positive pregnant women, and there is information around that. So we need to increase the outreach. We need to increase access geographically. And we prioritize also pregnant women for treatment for their own HIV. And that should assist us reduce transmission. And that should assist us also reduce maternal mortality. And it has been found recently now that it's the commonest cause of death among pregnant women. This aspect will require policy direction from the National Health Council, and basically around the issues of approaching how the approach to testing and also evidence on regimens that are effective. And this is what that the Department of Health will take on. But there will be a commitment in the plan to say Department of Health to address the policy gap in a particular area. Prevention still, minimize the risk of hospital exposure in health facilities, especially control exposure according to guidelines. But in terms of reducing transmission through blood, we say provide safe blood transfusion. And in intravenous drug users, we don't really know much about where to find this because of the legal environment around it. So we need to find some way of identifying who and where these intravenous drug users are and see how we can formulate a program around them. Thank you. The next big goal of hepatitis area rather is treatment, care and support. Provide an appropriate package of treatment, care and support services to 80% of HIV positive people and their families by 2011. HIV positive not as an estimate of the statistics that we see, but people who have been tested and found to be HIV positive, those ones, then we need to make sure at least 80% of them do get some package of treatment, care and support according to the stage of their disease. And the four main goals that are outlined under that one specifically is to improve screening and diagnosis through VCT. You will see that VCT has now moved from the prevention camp to the treatment, care and support camp, largely because evidence points to the fact that VCT may not be as effective a behavior change tool as we thought it would be previously. But it's very important for us, because the numbers are large, to screen and find the people so we can institute the interventions that need to be instituted as early as possible. So we'll move VCT from prevention now to the pack of treatment, care and support. It basically speaks to once more increasing coverage, access and outcome. And PCR is a test that you can use basically to diagnose infants who have been exposed, and you diagnose them earlier than you would if you didn't use the PCR. We will be expanding this activity. It requires, once more, policy direction for the National Health Council, particularly around this critical question of approach to testing. Continuing with treatment, care and support, then what do you do with the people that you find to be HIV positive? You improve health outcomes for those. There's a group who are symptomatic, there's a group who are not yet symptomatic, asymptomatic, HIV positive adults and children. And here, it may be about positive living. We think through the health system, particularly at district level, provide good quality care through standard treatment guidelines, ensure that, remember the principle, that provision of these commodities that are necessary are there, for people to provide training of service providers effectively in community-based activities. Improve health outcomes for symptomatic HIV-positive adults and children once more. We have to deal with TB. And it's basically around active case findings, both for HIV and TB, both ways. And it's also prevention of opportunistic infections, both for HIV, for AIDS, and also for TB. And it's provision of antiretroviral therapy for those TB patients that are eligible. Still, with improving health outcomes for symptomatic HIV positive adults and children, it continues to be positive living, ART, nutrition, and prevention of opportunistic infections. Then the section around still care, intimately care and support mitigate the impact on individuals and communities and in society. There's a concept now that people will hear that bended around a lot, building competent communities. Community level organization where communities organize themselves to understand their challenge of HIV and AIDS and the different groups among women, among children, among youth, and organizing how best to formulate a program at community level, working closely with NGOs and the health facilities, social development, and grant all of that at community level, competency at that level. Expand community home-based care within the expanded public health program, provide positive care for people who have terminal diseases, die with dignity, they don't have pain, they don't have diarrhea, and so on. The palliative care approach at community level needs to be centered. Often the vulnerable children are a huge problem, and there's a specific strategy by the Department of Social Development to deal with that, and we'll highlight a few things here and there in the plan. Youth, a specific target group, once more people with disabilities, how do we support older people to care and assist with education, especially at community level? They're doing a lot of work to go for them, they need to support it, capacity building, and the continuum of care in health facilities. The third key priority area is around research, monitoring, and surveillance. And here, I'm happy to report that this time we do have an M&E framework which has been developed already, and consultations around it are underway with people who understand how to put together measurable indicators, the necessity of monitoring, and all of those things. So there will be a formal M&E framework linked to the plan. The task team is also working on this. In terms of scientific research, we continue to support the development of vaccines, of microbicides, and we note the unfortunate developments in this regard. Male circumcision, we interrogating the evidence. Policy research, we need to assist the National Health Council to decide on how to approach HIV screening diagnosis. The things about the PMTC regimen, ART guidelines, this is a moving target, and we need to be on top of it all the time. It changes now and again, so we need to adapt quickly, nutrition strategies and research into different lessons. Operational research, we need to define more efficient models, especially around the implementation of the comprehensive plan, assess health system responses, and define resource requirements. Regular surveillance will continue on the question of prevalence incidence, if I may say, incidence is the measurement of new infections, prevalence being a measure of current infections. So if you want to get a sense of how effective your prevention program is, you need to measure incidence. And internationally, there are no tools in search for the measurement of incidence, and we're watching the space in this regard to see at what point then we'll have these tools and implement them. Critically, indeed, if you think that prevention is the most effective intervention in your program. Youth risk behavior, we continue to monitor through the surveillance program, and we continue also to monitor clinical and microbiological surveillance, which is why we manage research to test or to identify the problems with the gonorrhea in cases, and we will change the policies in that regard. On the last key priority area of human and legal rights, it's basically around the appropriate social environment, and anti-discrimination, stigma mitigation, monitor these abuses and so on. are there important sections that you will find that were not previously in the old plan? There's a section now on the costing. You know, working with the task team, everyone discussing which is proving the search to be complicated because of the nature of the interventions that are outlined in the plan. We're thinking that a ballpark figure needs to be worked out, and Treasury is assisting us with this. And then after that, we have a more detailed study to be carried out to detail exactly how much this plan will cost to implement. We also have a section that identifies the requirements for effective implementation. It speaks to the issues of policy gaps that need to be addressed. It speaks to the gaps in the regulatory environment that may need to be addressed. It also outlines time frames to be defined for operationalization by different sectors. So how are we going about all of this? The process underway and going forward. Sector consultations are ongoing by government and civil society. Tomorrow, in fact, we'll be meeting with the transport sector led by government. We'll also be meeting with other sectors of civil society. A task team of experts has been appointed, as I mentioned, and is meeting for the third time on Thursday, the 1st of March. They will have updated terms of reference. Project plan has been drawn, task allocated, much progress has been made by the team, and we are aiming to produce the first draft by the team on the 9th of March. We're planning to have a national consultation conference on the 15th and the 16th of March 2007, led by the Deputy President, the Chairperson of SANAC, as well as the Minister of Health. Plenary and commissions, that's basically the approach to that consultation, and we have detailed deliberation in commissions on the priority area specifically at that point. We are expecting about 500 people to be part of that in a wide sectoral representation. We hope then from there we'll get some kind of sense about how people feel on the plan and if there are any further strategic level inputs. We incorporate them and take that outcome then to SANAC, to the new SANAC for adoption, after which we popularize the plan and all of us then are responsible for implementation afterwards. In summary then, members of committee chairpersons, lastly, this plan maintains the old framework as mandated by SANAC. Two main goals, ambitious goals indeed. The four key priority areas, somewhat rearranged and expanded on. We consider here the current situation in terms of the epidemic evolution since 2000. Lessons from the previous response, policy environment and new scientific evidence. It's a statement of intent to once more define the what and the how much more than it does define exactly the detail of how these things will be done. Some costly and financial commitment, mainly from government. We outline there, we know that in the MTF period, the government is committed to put aside about 7 billion rands for the implementation of this system, which is not a little amount of money. But we think that other partners should come to the party and organizations and others. Comprehensive M&E framework, I've mentioned, with clear targets and indicators, and then we'll define an operational plan with time frames and responsibilities. And so the recommendations to the committee is that the fellow committee should take note of the approach to development of the MSP, the draft content thus far as presented, the progress made, as well as the plans towards finalization of this plan. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nomonde, for the report, presentation. Honorable members, we shall give them an opportunity to yourself to make comments and or ask questions. I will also take this opportunity to welcome the Director General, Mr. Amin Selig, who joined us during this presentation. Thank you very much. May we open it to the floor?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Doc, for your presentation. Briefly, we can make a comment. I think following on that, the large failure of that project, and with regard to the failure, how does that seem to be planned for that failure?
Just on page 4, line 3, there's reference to engaging the private sector and sort of with regard to the role of fixing companies within fixing. I wondered if you could elaborate the thinking around that a little more. And then on page 8, slide 1, you speak about the approach to testing being a critical question, and I hope you might be able to just elaborate a little around that. And on page 10, slide 2, policy gaps, regulatory environment or gaps, if you have, can give us some of your thinking around them. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the good comments on our approach to the development of this plan. We're hoping also when we get to the national consultation that we will at that point have reached some considerable level of consensus, and we shouldn't struggle at that point to finalize. But regarding the previous plan and what has been the biggest success of that plan, most of what we find the success in fact is defined in what we call output. You know, with an endemic like this, you want to see outcomes and impact quickly. But unfortunately, in a past-year period, you don't realize those outcomes and impacts as quickly as you can. I can tell you how many visitor facilities, scientific facilities, how many people have used condoms, the interest in condom research, the methods that have gone up, the level of knowledge now and awareness of HIV and AIDS that is persistent, the number of people on ART and nutrition and all of those things. But those are the output level successes of this plan. Huge, indeed, considerable success. But as I say, we need more time to professionally continue with all of these activities to realize the sort of outcome level in terms of taking the tide, the reversal of prevalence, and the reduction of incidence, and so on. So there's a lot to show in terms of what this is. The largest failure, I always call it failure as such, I call it a gap. It's that thing about an M&E framework that we didn't have with clear targets, which makes it difficult to quantify those things that you're asking for. And that's one of the things that we've done going forward. We said we cannot have a framework if we don't have an M&E framework with applying these indicators that are measurable and so on. But also within the plan, put there some kind of ambitious but realistic target that we all aspire to. And we need to remind ourselves that this indeed is a very ambitious, particularly the one that we put for prevention, because we don't have full control of that particular activity with an individual level responsibility that comes into the function. So it basically, you don't have your plan to fail kind of approach to it. Regarding Jefferson, the question that was asked on how then to interact with the private sector, particularly around STIs, there have been a few models that we've tried, one of them actually in this project, from which there are few lessons to learn. The most important thing, in matter of principle, is that we think we have to leverage on the private sector because of the human resource constraints that we have. We are now looking at the lessons and experiences through some of these models and programs that we have with the private, and we're having discussions already with the SPCA and South African Medical Association and so on to see how best to make those effective and minimize the risks. There are quite a few risks linked to that. Some of them from the surgeons, the medical surgeons and so on. So there's a few lessons to learn and we need to minimize this risk. Approach to testing, a very emotive and there's a lot of debate around how best to to increase uptake contest. And there are few strategies that have been counted, mainly led by the WHO and the UNAIDS. We would need to think carefully about issues of the environmental stigma that we're currently experiencing in the country. We would need also to look carefully at capacities to implement some of these recommended approaches. And we have discussions both with implementing agencies, with local groups, as to how best to formulate a strategy for testing that will increase uptake. There's no big question about geographic access to facilities. Mm-hmm. Most of the clinics, most of the hospitals, NGOs, everyone providing voluntary counseling and testing is just now getting people to do the actual test. In fact, our experience in terms of the city is that most of the people that take up the test are those who are already symptomatic, and you don't want to wait until people are symptomatic, but it's really late and it's difficult to reverse some of the complications. So we're trying to get to those who are asymptomatic, but know that they probably would have been exposed to HIV. We haven't had this discussion. It leads to your next question, is one of the W on policy gaps. Basically, it's the National Health Council Policy Committee that makes those kinds of decisions. It's up to us in terms of how we then assist that council to make those policy decisions. We've identified some of them. It's about this thing about development of resistance to treatment that we have for sexual transmitted infections. Do we need a policy change in terms of standard treatment guidelines? Those are some of the things that we're referring to. And it's basically committing to look at those and see how we best deal with them. Thank you, Chair.
Mine is on page 5. On the I just want to find out when you are going to involve the government social cluster. When, at what stage will you involve the financial social cluster, and in particular the portfolio committee on this? And on page 6, when you say you're going to reduce the rate of new infections by 50% at the end of this plan. So is that achievable in your view? And on page 2. In controlling the TB, I'd like to find out as to whether they before you get to the HDR TB, what about the multi-drug intervention? Because that will lead you to the HDR. Where are you covering it in your program? And on drugs that are not available for treatment for gonorrhea, how soon do you think you'll get the new drug that will be curing the disease?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Doctor, for this detailed report. I've just got another concern that it's been said previously that there are going to be a vaccine for HIV. I just want to know how far are you with the studies on the vaccine, and when will it be active?
Thank you, Chairperson. The DG will take the question on the
involvement of the social cluster of government departments and the parliamentary social cluster. Thanks for all of the questions from the honourable members. In terms of whether the 50% of reduction of new HIV infections over 50 or over the 5-year period is achievable, I have to be honest and say it is a very ambitious target. And we are hoping that if all of us South Africans did something, which we don't think that we all did enough in the past 5 years, in terms of particularly targeting the age group 15 to 24, where you can still do something about behavior change, and also increasing the uptake of some of the mother-to-child transmission prevention programs, and so on, particularly also using community-based activities, concerted community-based activities, we may move some ground to intensify what has been done already. I agree with you, it is ambitious, but you don't change failure, as I say, and I did actually put the caveat of this one, 50%, maybe we need to be cautious against it. It doesn't predict that will definitely happen. It's an ambitious strategy. In terms of the TB control, MDR and SDR, what we think is the problem with the development of both MDR and MDR is in fact problems with the whole TB control program, particularly defaulting treatment as community-based activity, which would require intensive social mobilization and community mobilization. That is why we say in this plan, competency of communities on a wide range of activities, a lot of work, consistency of what would need to be implemented at that level. But also the health system needs to be supportive to the implementation of the health program, the district health system specifically, the middle level managers and provision of drugs, laboratory systems, the reporting systems, all of that would need to be in place. We hope that by doing all of these things we'll minimize the development of MDR and the unfortunate XDR. And so we'll be working on strengthening the TB control program. And we have actually developed the TB crisis plan, and there is a plan also in the Department of Health to deal with XDR specifically. The question around drugs for gonorrhea, I just need to highlight and say that we do have standard treatment guidelines with the essential drug list for primary health care, covering or ensuring the availability of the drugs that are outlined in those treatment guides. These are standards. But we also have a surveillance system, a monitoring system, that seeks to check on the development of this resistance. You know, the approach to treatment of sexual transmitted infections is that we don't test everyone that comes. We give medication on suspicion of the cause. So when you do that, you run the risk also of developing this resistance that you find has come up in cases. But there's a surveillance system to monitor that and deal with it. Treatment guidelines have been changed in cases and to deal particularly with that matter. So there are other drugs, both covered by the CCN and also in the new treatment guidelines to treat the development of resistance for gonorrhea. It's a problem that we can do something about. It's certainly a big part of the XDR problem. Regarding checking the vaccine development, it's what I usually call optimism, striving over reality, or reality, if you may call it that. It will basically continue to hope for the best. It doesn't look good at the moment. There's work that is being done. But the challenge with this is the complexity of both the virus itself and the immune system. A lot of scientific work needs to be done at a very fine molecular level to define the virus itself and to define how the immune system functions when exposed to the virus. There are few things that are known. There are many other things that are currently unknown. That's why it continues to slip the scientists in terms of at what point we find an infectious vaccine. So it's worth it to be that if it's in progress. We don't think that in the next 5 to 7 years there will be an effective vaccine. No, because of what the scientists are telling us.
but we just continue supporting the development of that vaccine. And by so doing, we're also strengthening the research capacity in the country, and we're hoping that it basically the hope. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. On the, my apologies for arriving a little bit late. On the question of the involvement of the social class of parliament, and in particular the portfolio committee, we can say two things about that, Chairperson. One is that we would be guided by the portfolio committee itself as to how it would want to be involved. We cannot really prescribe for the legislative arm of government, particularly with regard to whether it would want to play an active executive role as well as a monitoring, like it's happening now. So we would actually be guided by Parliament. Our planning is more of an executive nature. So when we talk about the social class, we're talking about the executive part. And that is why we haven't actually put in the plan how the legislature should be involved. I think it's a presumption of us to do that.
I don't think you understood the question from the honorable member. In the presentation as given by Dr. Kuhn, he talks of the processes towards the adoption, the 7th of March, the 16th of March, etc., etc. And we are now going towards the final adoption of the strategic plan. The question by the honorable member is, as you are now almost at the end part of it, only now the parliament is involved in this process, to what extent, even you are talking of the national conference, to what extent is the role of parliament going to be between now and then? Already later, because I think that's my understanding of the question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, with regard to this matter, as I want to emphasize, it goes back to the issue that I'm raising, which is to say that from the point of view of Parliament, if we can, as I say, get guidance from the portfolio committee as to when exactly and what else we would need to do before the finalization of the plan to inform the portfolio committee. Because, as I say, from our planning, it's an executive function that we do anyway, with Parliament in relation to what we are doing on a number of matters. And sometimes the issue of when Parliament gives input on these matters, I think, is an ongoing discussion about at what stage Parliament should be involved, if it's not legislation, but it's policy and executive policy. So that's the point I'm trying to make. From our part, we would actually be just open to any guidance to say Parliament would like to be briefed on this or Parliament would like to be involved on that. We cannot determine that for Parliament. That's the point I'm raising.
Honorable Mashiko.
I would like clarity on the issue of capacity strengthening health systems at district level. This has been a problem, and in your discussion, you know that there was this coordination has not been there, and it didn't come out clear from what we discovered whether that problem has been capacity at the district. Lack of proper coordination right from national, province to district, because I think that's where stakeholders need to be involved so that the people we represent clearly see their problems being addressed. It is because there are no, they can't access whatever resources are there or lack of resources, or can it be a little bit clarified so that we understand what the problem has been and how we have addressed it, because there has been a problem of coordination at other provincial or district level so that people down there should receive whatever services they need to get. And the next one is palliative care. In your last year, you had 20, your target was 20%, and you achieved 10%. Is it right now a departmental priority, or how are you going to are the systems in place to make sure, because it is an important service, but are the systems in place and enough information for the service to be utilized in the community? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much,
Chair.
One need to say in this is the same good. Yes, it's good. The strategic plan for 2017 to 2011. But we need to cut the strategic plan, that is number one. We need number two to implement the strategic plan fully, that is number two, so as to realize some of our ambitious plan within the strategic plan for the state of the health sector of our people in this country. But the one factor is this review and restructure has been called up by SANAC. SANAC, which has failed to coordinate meetings for the past 2 years, to fully attend meetings for the past 2 years. Now, in that sense, how are we actually going to achieve some of the goals, intended objectives of the strategic plan for 2017-2018? Because when you look at what has happened, the strategic plan for 2005, again, it was failed. But because of some of the sloppy feet of stomach, some other things have been dropped down. And second to that, Chair, if indeed the restructure, can we be briefed as a committee on the following? One, what strategy is there in place for the to revise this interministerial committee? Because I think it is very key and very, very important. And second to that, I just wanted to know around the issue of treatment and prevention, the relevancy of some of medication, the whole thing of treatment around the pregnant women. Do we really regard the laboratory as so relevant at the present moment? And lastly, maybe one issue to ask, because in the previous plan, 2000-2005, the other thing was around the issue of the CVC. Are we still going to maintain the fact that our people will receive treatment only if their CVC are at this level, actually, or do we have something in place for that? Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson, and thank you for all of the questions. On the issue of centering the district health system, honorable member, you remember that I had categorically said that the plan, actually, as much as it acknowledges the challenges in the health system, will not be outlining how most of the things will be done, because it's not a health sector plan, it's a statement of intent that needs then to be operationalized at different levels. So the health sector and the health department will then need to take this plan. And out of the issues that have been identified to be challenges by that, for that particular department, will then put together strategies on how best to deal with them. Just suffice perhaps to say for now, that we do acknowledge the challenges that exist in health system. And it is not only affecting HIV and AIDS, but because HIV and AIDS is so much in your face, it will actually make this thing lay them out, so to speak. There are many problems with human resources, with physical infrastructure, with information, commodities. And there's a lot of work that is currently underway to do that.
I think that it's important to, at the level of strategic plan, recognize those challenges, and then at the level of the responsible government department, put together a plan to deal with them. And then you will find that plan only in the HIV engagement. You will find, in fact, the reading of the department, which means an accessible, equitable health system, you will find something that to deal with those issues. The question of quality of care, the Honourable Member is saying that only 10% was achieved, and the question is whether this is the government's priority. In fact, what we've done now through the community home-based care program is to mainstream palliative care, which we previously didn't. There's a program specific now for palliative care, which seeks to ensure that people who have terminal diseases die with dignity, whether they are at the facility or they are at home. So the effective links between the clinic and the community-based activities are being strengthened so that there's no break in the provision of this much-needed medication for pain control, for control of diarrhea, and other commodities. So there is a program specifically mentioned in palliative care in community-based care at district level. The other question that has been raised is around costing. I have indicated that we looked at this plan and everyone agreed that the tax scheme, the aspect tax scheme, that it's actually complex and it would be difficult to come up with a definite cost figure by the time that we take it to another consultation, but there will be a board tax scheme. Then work will begin for a detailed costing study to be done, which should take something like 6 to 9 months or so, outlining the actual cost of that plan. But I think that members should be comforted by the commitment that is put in the plan from the MTX in terms of government saying the next year there will be 7 billion to assist government specifically. And then we know also there's a lot of additionality coming from Americans, from DC and others to assist. It's just the challenge of harmonizing for better efficiency. So yes, the cost is important. The costing of the plan is important, and the commitment to do that. Implement fully. I agree with you fully, and it's not only the government responsibility, the responsibility of all of us. And if we all do it, I think that we will be able to reach the ambitious target. The review or restructuring of SANAC and this program being led by SANAC, we say we cannot take a medical approach to dealing with HIV. It's going to help to be a developmental and multisectoral approach. And there's no better sort of structure to drive that than SANAC. We do appreciate the challenges that we had, and it's also coming out of the assessment report. And you will find that, and maybe we'll get the opportunity to brief the committee on the approach to how then to restructure SANAC, having assessed these challenges and these weaknesses. We now moving forward with a more organized and a legacy stick to that. The briefing on links basically to that question of the Interministerial Committee and the revival and so on. But maybe I should just quickly respond to the question of Nevaratin and PMCC and CD4 count. This is a technical question suggesting that the approach that we took was to say we have implemented the Nevaratin based PMCC program for the past 5 years now. What have we gotten out of it? And the critical question that gets asked is how many babies have we saved from the vaccine? We have saved a few babies. Problem is, the assessment that we did, which was in 4 facilities, 2 of them were Western Cape based, 2 were one was in Cape and one was in the Eastern Cape. You can't generalize in the different zones, but it tells you something. What it tells us is that where your health system is not strong enough to support a particular intervention, you won't get the same benefit. Because what you got from CAR, for instance, was the expected 50% reduction in the use of Nevaratin. But what you got in Umzimkhulu was it was like we did nothing. Because of all of the structural and systemic issues that you find. Systems, the health system based, but also fundamental drivers of underdevelopment and poor access to some of these services. So, Nevaratin does it, but if you don't have this sort of background, institutional and development issues to support a program, you won't get the benefits that you expect. We do take note of the developments in terms of efficacy and so on, but I think that we should be cautious in just accepting that as the main answer to the issue, because the problem was defined. It's defined the problem as institution and personal issue. Do we then respond to that by changing the regime? I think that will assist, but it won't deal with your fundamental problem on the agreement. Yes, we were looking at the evidence, and it's one of the policy areas that we're addressing. On the question of the CD4 count of 200, we had a discussion once more with experts on this issue. And the feeling is that, looking at the estimated number of people who probably have CD4 count of 200 living with HIV, the numbers are still very few. So if you expand that to a higher level of CD4 count, you may just be setting yourself up for failure because you may not be able to reach that bigger pool of people with the necessary intervention. Why don't we, once we're implementing this comprehensive plan, first make sure that we reach these people with a CD4 count at a level of 200. We're currently now doing a mid-term review of the comprehensive plan to look back and say, what are the things that we can do better to assist us to increase the scale or increase, accelerate the speed of the scale-up. So as soon as we understand those things, perhaps then we start considering expanding the sort of level at which we can start treating. Technically though, if you have this large number and you expanded your program to include the people, then we're not able to do that. There's a risk of losing the people who need treatment as early as possible, which is low to before. So which is why then the policy of concentration of the low CD4 of 200 is currently the one that we're implementing until we get a better sense of how best we can improve on the comprehensive thing. I'll stop there, Chuck.
I was saying that if you were going to respond on another part of the question that I've asked.
First of all, just to add to the issue of stomach, I agree that the stomach has actually not been functional for the past 2 years. But the very fact that we are able to present such a plan shows you that we have a different stomach even before it is restructured, because of the vibrancy that has been going on, the agreements and the processes, all the processes that are outlined are not just the dream of the department, but are actually agreed upon in that summer, it in fact in its current nature was reviewing itself. So as part of reviewing itself, it also reviewed the NSP. And in relation to reviewing itself, it's a long presentation that one can make, but just to say that the key structural change within SANAC is one which says that everybody has been calling for leadership, but in fact leadership is only seen at government level. So what we have had in SANAC is a situation where at government level you have the deputy president and all the ministers meeting with functionaries from various sectors of the NGO sector, the civil sector. For example, you would never have a SANAC currently where the leadership of COSATU, NATU, and FEDUSA would be sitting at SANAC. That's not what happens. Yes, the leadership of government was sitting at SANAC. Same thing, you wouldn't have, even within the context of the NGO sector, you have mainly people who were functionaries and employees, not the chairpersons of the board, etc. So, similarly with business, you have the organization and the people that are working on the organization rather than the leadership of business. So, the main change is related to restructuring such that it is really a leadership structure from all walks of life, whether you're talking about academics, you're talking about the media, you're talking about business, the people at leadership level that would be participating in that structure, and then you have operational structures that would actually be taking mandate from that bigger structure. That's in summary, but at some stage we could explain that. And then the IMC itself has been, as you know, resuscitated and has a different kind of energy because it leads to these processes of restructuring. So I don't think there's a if all that works, and I'm optimistic that everybody is keen to make it work, then all these issues that relate to the MSP are not going to be that much of a problem, because we have a size of the of engagement. Just two quick things with regards to some of the answers that have been given. I just want to emphasize that while we continue as the staff to look at the system issues to strengthen the PMDCP and therefore the developing program, we also, as Dr. Kumba said, we're also looking very carefully at the evidence that is coming from various scientific studies. The problem with policy making, is that you have to be sure what you are actually getting into, because scientists differ from time to time. There's evidence that there's actually this thing is causing more resistance among the mothers themselves, if it is not in combination. Others come almost 2 months later than other studies, and they say, actually, that is not true. So I feel that the studies have been established. It's important to look at what you're doing and do it well, and not actually just take policy decisions on the basis of debates that are still going on about this issue. So that's what we're looking. We're watching the space that it's in with regard to evidence. I also just want to say that the CD4 count is 200 stories. Doesn't just come from a thumb tank. It's advice from the World Health Organization, and therefore we have followed that advice, and we'd like to strengthen our response with regard to that advice without excluding the possibilities of moving to higher levels of CD4 count. But also there are other challenges with regard to that. If we are beginning to see, and here in the Western Cape you see evidence of that, if we are beginning to see some of the challenges of resistance as a result of a longer period of treatment, and therefore needing to change the treatment regimen, then we need to be able to see how many people we can actually perhaps manage in different ways and in moving immediately to treatment, because we'll also be creating that challenge. The other challenge here in the Western Cape is also the challenge of a growth in numbers of people. It's not just in the Western Cape, but because we were here last week, we actually were exposed to people who are actually having an impact of a mental nature as a result of the status as well as the treatment that is involved. That it doesn't actually, this is not a statement on treatment, it's a statement on the fact that you have to manage these things. And therefore, you need to be able to be sure why you're expanding to people with CD4 count of 250 when you still have to deal with the challenges of the numbers that are coming, with all sorts of challenges of management of the treatment around even the CD4 count 200. So it's a very conscious decision not to move in that direction, both from advice, international advice, and also from our own assessment that we don't think the system is actually ready, not just to manage the numbers, but to manage the implications in relation to the impact on the numbers of people actually on treatment. Because there are serious challenges that unfortunately have not been put on the table, because we've been concentrating on at least expanding the program. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, PG, for your responses. No, we see. The honorable member around the 54 count, and I'm sure some of the discussion you've been talking about towards. But I think the point Dr. Kongo is very important rather than the paper. It's more the concentration of the magnitude rather than perhaps some of the technical issues. Because evidence that is emerging from the field of the medicine also says sometimes your intervention at 200 is late. Well, there may be a correlation between the CD4 count and the blood count. You may still have the 300 CD4 count, but your blood count shooting up. And if you don't intervene when the blood count is up, you may have a problem with it. But I think the key question is the capacity. If we then say we increase at this level, then what capacity? And I think Dr. Kumbu says, I think for us principals, I think it's a point that I agree with. But principals, I think that you just take what you can chew. I think that's what she's after that fighting us. At this point in time, you never know, maybe when your capacity has increased, you may have to look into other areas in this area. And I think the key question, I would advise another member, and I think the DG is right, maybe at some point around the SANAC, the structure, I mean, let's leave it now because, as you say, it's quite a discussion on its own. We don't have to advise us on that broader discussion around the structure of the SANAC. Even this question, I think this is quite innovative question. Rather than to have this functional, you actually have leaders so that when they talk on the basis of information. We'll come back to those questions. There's an advice that she is finding. I'm always accused that I always allow people for tea when it's cold. So can I be disciplined, honorable Garrett? Then we'll come back and take questions afterwards. Thanks.
Wonderful, that's great. Thank you very much for coming.
Just
going to
have coffee.
Email this. Email.
Thank you.
I'm not sure about his name, but I normally look it up in the internet. But you do get a few people like this where you can go and ask them for to write down.
Okay.
Okay. I'll probably ask her before this when you know the end.
Thank you very much. One of Ruth Magella.
Yeah.
Thank you, Shepherdson. Shepherdson, my part of the question was asked by Honorable Master Mayor regarding the City Hall Council 210. My, as a leg of the question is around the issue of less city council of 200 and grand. The status as of now, stated only getting grants and they are the focal business and funding. For me, it seems that this does not help because we wait until those persons are very ill, then, especially those who are poor and unemployed, maybe. Are we going to see a shift in that? And my other question, my concern is not a question, but can the department reassure this committee that the billions of grants that have been allocated to them, the tokens of HIV, are we going to see them implemented, not to see them sitting in the shelves and coffers of the Senate or whatever is responsible for? Another one is, are we having a process of breakthrough with regards to destigmatization and anti-discrimination of patients who are living with HIV and AIDS? Thank you.
Thank you
Shepherdson. I will respond specifically to the question on competent communities and that. Give others to the DG to assist me. The way we have conceived this intervention is by perhaps going the ward-based approach whereby ward committee would seek to understand what the challenge is in their specific community regarding HIV and AIDS in terms of saying what is the prevalence in this specific community, who is most at risk, how are we organized to deal with it, how can we operationalize the specific plan to the specificities of the community, how can we develop a program for this community, what funds are available, what services are available in terms of social development, health, agriculture, and so on, what
M&E framework can we put together around our own program? Who are the leaders? And put together this program, together with an M&E framework. See what resources are available. Put together proposals to access additional funding. And have some kind of community-based concerted effort to deal specifically with what sort of capacity do we need, who needs training, at what level, how can you access the youth, the church, the women, and so on. This is the concept that we're talking about, competent communities, and there's a way of grading the level of competence, and it will come out in the particular program, from grade 1 to grade 5, in terms of level of competence. There's a specific approach to it. Thank you.
The when you started with this issue of CD4 counts and grants, first of all, you have to clarify that the people who could receive grants do not receive them because of their CD4 counts or HIV status. They receive them because of temporary disability. And therefore, if they are seen no longer to be temporarily able, then they are taken off the grant. Now this is an issue that has been raised as a concern by a number of AIDS organizations to say, therefore it promotes people not taking their treatment because they want to be on the grant, given the context in which you operate. But the government actually started the process almost a year ago, I think, of looking at what we need to do to put in place some social assistance for people with chronic illnesses. And that is in the process of being finalized. You know, it's led by the Department of Health, but the social cluster is finalizing it, I think, by, if I'm not mistaken, in the program of action in terms of June, July. So as to deal with all these gaps in the social security system, where people, because of their CD4 count level, they actually receive temporary disability grants, and therefore they want to stay on the temporary grant, in fact the temporary grant, and therefore do not take their treatment. So that's being solved by looking at a broader issue of chronic diseases and social security. With regard to the relationship between SANAC and the Provincial AIDS Council, what has been agreed upon at the moment is that we need to finalize agreements with regard to SANAC at a national level. And on the basis of that model, see if we can replicate the same model in all provinces. In other words, look at restructured SANAC and Provincial AIDS Council. There are challenges though, because some of these eight councils in some provinces are actually legislated. You know, there's a law that says this is how it's going to be structured. And in others, it's actually an organization run by people outside. It's not necessarily in the government sense. So we're trying to bring about uniformity, first by agreeing at the national level what kind of structure we're going to have, and then by looking at how these provincial structures and can replicate the national structure. So at the moment, the structural links have not been outlined yet, because we're still dealing with what structure in the first place. Once we reach that agreement, there will be discussion about how we actually ensure that all these structures are actually similar. The third issue is the issue of availability of medicine. I think it's both facilities and medicine. Facilities in relation to proper clinics in some places. We still need to roll out in some of our provinces more clinics, so that people have access to better and community health centers. But the availability of medicine also, it's an interesting challenge, because when we begin to examine it, we find that in most of the clinics, there is always, say, 90% of the medicines we need are actually here. They are available in the pharmacy. So it becomes a challenge of those outlying, like mobile clinics, where they have to actually move those. But the experience of the people, when they speak, they say, we don't get medicine we're looking for when we come here. But it tends to be perhaps those medicines, it might be the 10% of the medicines that are not kept in that particular pharmacy for various reasons, because it doesn't meet certain standards, and therefore they are not readily available to people to come at different times. But also, the other problem is how people manage, particularly your chronic illnesses, the growth of people when they come and look for their medicine. We found that just by changing the system of how they manage them, so that they come at a certain time, you know, in GF Yester, for example, and in Kailisha, they were talking about, say, people know exactly when they are coming for their medicine, so they, and if they come in there, it will take them not more than 30 minutes to get out of that place because of the system. Whereas it would take them 4 hours to stand in a queue just to collect their medicine. It's just a system issue sometimes. So these issues are not availability more than management of what people have as a resource. So we need to actually strengthen those system issues at all levels.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I would like clarity from both G and Doctor, because there are two approaches from SANEC, which I really not able to understand how are they going to be implemented. This is vis-a-vis the question that was raised as to what is the relationship between SANEC and the provincial aid councils and the DAC, the district aid council and the local aid council. The doctor said they want to attenuate the term ward-based competency, whereby the community itself will be able to identify the disease and know the prevalence in the community. And at the same time, the GV said the PAC and the JCs and the LACs are not yet well structured. They want to reorganize them and replicate the structure that is in SANEC or a cost or build uniformity. Now my concern is that maybe in other provinces there are those disclassification and AC that are not here in Kachina. But in other provinces there are whereby the KC is headed by the NC, the DAC by the mayor, and you find that the very people of the world are the main stakeholders in this structure. Now, if at another time we are going to focus on the members of the world within the committee, and already in that community, we have the DAC and the LAC, LAC that is fully functional. Are we not going to cause an environment that is going to be non-conducive for both to function? Because in the world, I believe, there has to be councillors and there has to be the CBOs and the NGOs, the traditional leaders and so on. And the same people, we find them in the KCAC and NC. So how are you going to care that conflict that might be that?
I would like you to excuse me, but I'm going to start with one and then read the second. But I think that may be the last question. I think there is no contradiction really between saying that we are focusing on making sure that we empower this work in terms of creating copies, that's not meant to create structure. It's a program which will be carried out by the very structure which you are referring to, the AC and so on. So the idea is not to create another structure, to create a community. Now it's a program which will be determined by that DAC in terms of how, what are the gaps in this community, and if the grade is one, how do we actually move it forward. That's the same factor that we actually deal with now. And that's our thing. In some instances, these are functional structures, some of them are legislative. So there's a whole variety of how these structures are formed. We have to look at how to deal with them. With regard to the MC and the next line of drugs, some of these next line of drugs are already actually registered. By the MCC, and others are in the process and the pipeline of being registered. So the issue may not necessarily be the challenge of registration of the second line of staff, but more than the expense, and more than not the cost to actually move to those tracks. Whereas by illustration, it costs 100 rand per month to fit some of the first line staff. The second line grant would be 1,000 at the moment. So the issue would be access and cost for the second line grant. Which is why, if you look at some some of the organizations that have been involved in fitness, particularly in the UK. As soon as they reach that kind of challenge, they want the government to take over. And part of the problem is related also to cost, very, very costly with the availability. I think many of these pharmaceutical companies are lining up for this aspect that they're actually submitting a number of dossiers for purposes of producing generics and producing even second line drugs. Problem with second line drugs is that you find that many of them are not necessarily available in generic form because they're still patent protection. So part of the struggle would be how to actually open up. With regard to the common army process and the tender, the process is still ongoing. The certain issue, unfortunately, we can't speak about what the process is and what the challenges are in this kind of thing because we are responding to the participants with that. But let's say that we are trying to really finalize this as soon as possible. The review that we undertook, we eventually got a response from the group that had done this previously. And from that report, we picked up some of the issues that we had sent, which we put into the new tender. Those good things that they said were good, and some of the challenges that were there. But I think part of the issue was that we're doing this at the same time as this plan suggests that our prevention strategies themselves may need to shift. So we may actually be pushing one emphasis when in fact our own program and plan says, while we sustain this way, we need to actually put other emphasis than the targeting as Dr. Kundo was talking about. But I think she will elaborate further. The only thing I can say about the opt-out, and I think again Dr. Kundo will elaborate further, is that again, it's one of those issues where there's an ongoing debate. If you take countries like Botswana, that have actually always been like that, you would have seen the difference, but you don't. And so people argue to say, okay, what will it do? But other people argue that perhaps that's a policy position that we should take. And then it's part of the processes of the policy gap that will be presented. And some of these policy gaps, in fact, maybe the 15th and the 16th may be a further platform for debate around those policy gaps, around this particular issue, for example, because it's one of the issues that people raise. But body of evidence from different sides comes in, you know, to say perhaps this methodology may not work in our context or may work. Where has it ever worked? Other people argue that it's not the case with anyone. I have to say, but you've never tried. So that's the ongoing debate and part of the political, including the whether you counsel after testing. As I understood, you have talking about the process compulsion. I think at the moment it's the same kind of thing. There's voluntary counseling and testing. Now, you talk about a possibility where everybody is counseled to take an HIV test and then they opt out if they want. And that's what I'm saying, it's part of the discussion that we're looking at in terms of these policy questions. Check, if you don't mind, that let's have another meeting.
Thank you, Susan. If I may just add on to the DJ's response to the question around VCT. Basically, as the DJ is saying, it's debate ongoing, but we feel that what is called provider-initiated testing that targets specifically the known at-risk populations like your TB patients, your sexual transmitted infection patients, pregnant women, people who present with one opportunistic infection or the other. We're talking also about family planning, youth, and so on. Those ones, it shouldn't be too difficult for the system to offer routine testing. not test routinely, but routinely offer the test, giving information, the free information, providing the test. It will be limited, obviously, by the capacity of the system to provide that kind of service, and we need to assess that carefully. Also, the question of information management. But as the DG is saying, the debate that is going on, local groups may have different positions only in terms of human rights issues and so on. And we also interrogating the evidence around it. On the question of the future line of drug, members will be reminded that we have two lines of the region. We don't only have one line, but even in the line, we have two groups of drugs that seek to deal with the question of drug-drug interaction, especially where you have co-infection with TB, which is the commonest opportunity for infection. So there are ways of managing that within the first line. And then where you fail on the first line, on those two regimens on the first line, you get on the second line. Now there's not too many of the people who are on ART that are currently on the second line at the moment. It has not been a pressing need to move over to first line because of the high adherence rate and so on, the good work that happens in communities and support groups. But what also is coming up as a major problem is not so much resistance than it is the complications, the side effects from one of the most potent first-line drugs in effect. And when you speak to expert clinicians around this, there are ways to go around it. You could reduce the dose of that particular problematic drug, and it refers to mental illnesses and complications and so on. The commonest is painful feet and you need to deal with that. Clinicians are telling us that if you reduce the dose of this particular problematic drug, you don't take from the efficacy of it. Whilst you are waiting on the system of research, these other alternatives that are perhaps safer than the one that you're currently using. So we're now looking at reviewing the guidelines to reduce that particular problematic drug whilst there's work going on in terms of fast-tracking these other lines of drugs. Regarding, if I may add, Chairperson, on the question of competent communities, I think this program is going to be critical in making us effective in realizing this goal, and we need our encourage members to embrace it. The question that is being raised of the systems overlap and redundancy and so on, I think he has responded correctly in saying that we're not creating a new system, but you are better organizing for better efficiency. Obviously, you scan the environment in terms of who is in this community doing what, who is responsible for what, how do we put it together around this specific program that is managed and monitored across this grading of competence. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to ask, my question is going to be based on funding. The doctor said funds that are available, but there are NGOs, I know of an NGO in my constituency, which I referred to last year in March when the strategic plan of the DOH was presented here. That it does a lot of work, it works very well with the community and the local municipality, but for the past 2 years, it has never been funded. They submit whatever documents you request from the department, but no funding, no monitoring, no evaluation, nothing. They just get no response. So if there is funding and that thing is not in place like that, is that not discouraging the people who really volunteer and the home-based caregivers who genuinely do their work and right now without funding because they are interested in the work? How is your funding and what criteria do you need? That strategy to stop funding an NGO that is in funding and recommending and increasing its funds, but strategy for the past 2 years here. So I think that's a source of concern for maybe not only that community, but many other NGOs and directly from the National Department of Funding. Thank you.
Yeah, mine is on page 7, slide 2, under
5 test pregnant women for ART by reducing maternal mortality. I just want to find out. Towards the end of last year, there was an outcry of maternal mortality going up in growth. I would like to know, when you deal with the asymptomatic part of your program, do you treat those women who present themselves with the preventable preventable diseases, illnesses, like hypertension, diabetes, and the like? Do you treat them or do you refer them elsewhere? My second question will be on the on your page 8, when you deal with the question I asked you on page 8. The question I'm now going to ask you on page 10. I'm not confused myself. Yeah. In the past, the homosexuality was said to be prone to infectious disease. Recently, it is now heterosexual who are also prone to HIV. In your view, which one is higher than the other? Is the homosexuality, taking into account what is happening in the prison and with the men and men partners. I just want to find out as to whether that is still what it used to be or has it gone down a bit.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm on page 9 of the presentation. And research, monitoring, and surveillance. In terms of the strategic plan of 2000 to 2005, under bullet 3, on comprehensive plan for HIV screening and diagnosis is visited whatever CMPC students in there. What I see right now is the inclusion of traditional medicine. Maybe one needs to be briefed to check how far is the department go for now, maybe to get hold of those traditional medicines within, or the recognition in essence of this traditional medicine in terms of treatment on HIV. And the other thing is around the issue of scientific research. I just want to check as to whether this has been included now into a comprehensive plan for HIV and AIDS and HIV. If you look at vaccines, microbicides, and maize become fishy. And maybe one needs to understand what informs the research about the maize become fishy. Because sometimes you find to eat that. Sort of those who are circumcised would sort of be killed in terms of the rudeness. Now I just want you to find out as to whether this scientific research has a proof to it that if males are circumcised, maybe they've got a less, sort of a less, the likelihood of not contracting the HIV virus as such, because I can see now that this could be included in the whole set that will be envisaged by the strategic plan for 2007. Thank you very much.
I'm
But you can see sometimes the tendency for us to struggle with the question of the operation. There's sometimes a tendency from us to struggle on issues that we feel to deal with in other segments of our work, for instance, what the issue around the justification of blood. And issue perhaps with the dealing with when we deal with the MCC, for example. So take those into account. The issues like the question of NGO funding. Issues with dealing with the rest when we deal with another part of the Department of Health. And so take those things into account when you respond. We'll come back to those issues. But your presentation here was for the strategic plan draft that you are.
Thank you, Chairperson. That's very useful, but we'll also use the opportunity to share whatever information we have when some of the evidence that has been raised. Regarding the energy of funding, yes, there will be, as the Chairperson indicating, better time to discuss the detail of that. Perhaps suffice to say for now that we grade NGOs into national NGOs, which by definition they should be present in three or more provinces providing a comprehensive package of services. And then you also have provincial NGOs, which are mainly monitored and funded by the provincial department through the equitable share. So the national department NGO unit will be looking mainly after those NGOs that are called so-called national NGOs. Would you find in some instances where provinces perhaps don't have the requisite capacity to monitor or make an effective NGO running unit, and you are aware which those provinces are, and you are providing support to those provinces to ensure that service delivery happens, and we'll find ourselves having to then fund a provincial NGO where we're supposed to, where there are systems issues. So there's work around that. Remember, I'm not aware of the reasons exactly of why that particular specific NGO, the funding of what was removed or taken away, would need to get to the detail of that. It may well be that perhaps the issues with performance, with governance, with all of those. So it wouldn't be prudent for me to respond to your specific question. It would need to get more details to us.
But regarding chairperson, the question of maternal mortality and PMCCT, there are broad guidelines which are actually implemented by the Unit of Maternal and Child Health, which seek to reduce all of these identified causes of maternal mortality, which unfortunately recently have been identified mainly to be non-pregnancy related problems, infectious diseases and so on. And when we put this intervention of prioritizing pregnant women who are HIV infected and eligible for ART, we're seeking to deal with that specifically. And it should assist us to reduce transmission but also reduce mortality in terms of living longer lives or treatment and so on for those who are eligible for treatment. The question of homosexuality and the nature of the epidemic here is actually quite an interesting debate, in the sense that initially when the first cases of AIDS were identified in the US, it was when people saw an emergence of new opportunistic infections, which were seen mainly in homosexual men. And when they looked back, they saw that these men in fact held this immunodeficiency syndrome, which was then linked to the infection of HIV. Interestingly, though, coming down south to ourselves in the region, this has changed. We actually can confidently say at this stage that the driver or the important risk factor of HIV transmission in Africa, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, is this heterosexual transmission for various reasons, fundamental of which are these things of poverty, gender imbalances, underdevelopment and so on. But also specifically, we know that it's the multiple partnerships, it is inconsistency of condoms, if you want to get to that level. But fundamentally, it's this problem that we have that fuel the spread amongst the heterosexuals in sub-Saharan Africa and specifically ourselves here. And the question that is linked to that is, are we now going to be forgetting about men who have sex with men as an important risk group? No, we cannot afford to do that. But the challenge that we have with that is these groups are diffusely integrated into society, and so it's difficult to design a program around them. Yes, you do get incarcerated men in prison that you could design a program for. Last week, in fact, we had a discussion with the Department of Correctional Services, where they will be giving us the report from their family that they've done in terms of prevalence in prison. We'll get now from there a better understanding of how big this problem is there, and we'll put it in the situation analysis in the NSP. But it's up to correctional services to take this plan and operationalize it for specific programs for correctional services. Bearing in mind that this is a very mobile population, people don't stay in prison for long periods, and we need to have effective links when they go back to society and to communities. How do you continue to make sure that they are safe from infection and still continue with all of those interventions? So we had this discussion, and you should see a mention of how big the problem is based on what was found from that study. Traditional medicine, honorable member, you will see that we put that in specifically in the research aspect of the plan, largely because we don't understand much about the safety, efficacy, acceptability, affordability, feasibility of all of these traditional medicines. So it's work in progress and it's put under research. We have a concerted effort with the presidential task team to look at traditional medicines and indigenous knowledge to ensure indeed that the system of research supports the development of these interventions. We haven't seen them, well, we cannot ignore that. But we have a responsibility to make sure that they are safe and effective, and that is basically what we said. You won't see it in the plan that's being implemented. You see it in the effect aspect supported to ensure that we get the results that we need to get across. There's a few of others, one of them, that you have put as part of the program, which are actually under research. Medical competition is one of them. We're not saying we're going in second class or second class men tomorrow. No, we can't do that. Not at this stage. We need to understand the rigor of the research that we've done, the implications culturally, systematically, and so on, and it's well that it's underway internationally, and reasonable people understand that that's not acceptable for us. Thank you.
Well,
that's
to thank Dr. Kumonte for a very good presentation. But it's quite clear, honorable members, that the issues raised in the process indicated it's easier to engage with it as it unfolds. Principally, of course, there will be a number of challenges. And I think the caveat she put around the fact that the key focus for us in particular would be to what extent is this actually going to be unfolding in practice on the ground. And that is where, in our own way, perhaps the monitoring and evaluation processes are going to take place. And that's where we're going to play our role in this regard. But I think so far, a number of issues, but we may still have to see when it's actually finalized and unpacked exactly what is placed in detail on a number of issues. For instance, I was listening to this thing of the PCP. And I mean, for instance, we have to see what it says with regard to discrimination in the insurance industry. And I think one of the members who came to make submission to us in terms of the burial policies they have, and then when they die, and then they are tested, and then they do from their small cases of burial society. We have to see, for instance, the relationship between the GPs that are found in our community and their relationship with the Department of Health. Because the capacity in the department and the state is not to them. But we are finding sometimes the readiness of the GPs, some are keen to us and actually indicated they want to play a role. To what extent is that relationship in dealing with some of those areas? I think Honorable Karen Morgan was raising this point of the MCC and the Tamiya's registration of drugs, and perhaps where does the problem? We need to understand what are the blockages. You know, I think some people are saying there's a lot of backlog in the statistical process. And I'm sure in our process of the portfolio committee, we'll have to see how we deal with some of those things that are actually being raised. But it's quite clear, I think, that the plan as a whole, I think to echo what Honorable Morgan was saying, I think it's a very good plan, and I think it's taking us forward. There is a possibility for a broader buy-in around this particular plan. Everybody will feel part and parcel of this particular process. And I think it's going to take us forward in addressing a number of challenges. We'll come back around the question of SANAC and understand what are the challenges. All of us have problems. I think let's rather approach it in a dynamic way, say, in the restructuring process of the taking place. What is then happening that we understand this relationship, therefore, to what is taking place. But I must say, therefore, on behalf of the honorable members, we must thank the presentation. Thank you very much. We'll continue to interact with you around this particular area, that issue of every that fall. I'm informed, the honorable members, that there's lunch at 1 o'clock. At the Mark building. We are all invited to lunch at the Mark building at 1 o'clock, right? So let's do whatever we want to do now, then maybe lunchtime we can all meet at this. Thank you very much.
A lot of people find it
frustration you have of the function of the permanent committee because the function of the staff that it seems like a lot of work for Yeah, it's